Modern gynecology in the U.S. was largely born in the antebellum South. That's because some of the country's first gynecologists conducted their experiments on enslaved women. That history is explored in a new book that's called Medical Bondage, Race, Gender, and the Origins of American Gynecology. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. Author Deirdre Cooper Owens is an assistant professor at Queens College in New York. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's interesting that this book, and I'm sure considering how well researched it is, that you started work on this book quite some time ago. But this is a topic that has come up, especially because of the statue in New York that women are protesting that they bring down, which is a statue of a man who did many of the things that you describe in your book, that he studied gynecology by experimenting on mostly enslaved women. Why do you think this topic is coming up now?
It's coming up in light of the contentious history, but also political issue of the Confederate statue removal. And so it's interesting for me as a historian of medicine and race and slavery that calls for James Marion Sims's statue to be removed has really recycled itself about every 8 to 10 years. So when I finished my dissertation in 2008, I remember with the publication of two other books by Harriet Washington and Marie Jenkins Schwartz that there had been some really pointed demands by a lot of activists to have his statue removed. But I think it's being taken much more seriously in the mainstream media and also by other Americans because it stands in the light of the Confederate statue removal that's going on so many different places throughout the South and the Northeast.
And I also actually read a commentary coming out of New York that they feel one of the reasons the issue is being taken more seriously is because white women have joined in the protest, whereas oftentimes, largely, it was African-American women protesting before. What do you make of that argument?
You know, it certainly would probably be true, as a student and a teacher of American history. Typically, when you have members of white communities join in solidarity with people of color, those protests are often and demands are often taken much more seriously. They're given a bit more credence. I know in New York, the issue is still in the air. You know, the Parks Commission in the city hasn't really made any statements about the statue staying or being removed. I think a couple of years ago, there had been some updates about possibly recontextualizing the commemorative plaque on the statue in Central Park.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, those folk I know who are working on the issue are really just waiting. And it seems as if the New York City Parks Commission is unfortunately silent on this issue that's so timely for others.
Yeah, and before we get down south, let's talk one more time about James Marion Sims and the effort to remove the statue on Fifth Avenue. He actually founded the country's first women's hospital there. That was in the 1850s. Here's Harriet Washington. She's author of Medical Apartheid, and she's speaking at a community forum in Harlem from earlier this year.
These women were rendered unfit for work by their horrible condition, a condition which Dr. Sims ascribed to their being black women who were sexually profligate because all black women were viewed that way, and who were dirty because black people were viewed that way, and who were result of their practices.
I wonder what kind of resonance you find there, that description of how they were treated up north in New York, with the studies that you did into what was happening in the South.
Okay, so it's interesting. So with Sims, I always correct this statement, and it literally starts my book. The first slave hospital that was founded for women was actually founded in Alabama by James Marion Sims, and he states this in his memoirs and also in his other writings and speeches. And so he begins work on enslaved women in Alabama. Once he relocates to New York City, he begins working on a more diverse patient body, but largely those who are coming in are poor, and many are recently arrived immigrants. So the first patient that he serves at this hospital in New York is Mary Smith, who is an Irish immigrant who who had recently come to the United States not long before. And so there is a very much a way that Black people, the enslaved especially, have been viewed in American society, particularly in the 18th and 19th century with the rise of racial science and all ideas about Black people being vectors for disease. And then you can see that same kind of mapping of Blackness, I call it, being placed on the bodies of another, you know, quote unquote, degraded group of women who would be poor Irish immigrant women who were treated almost similarly by James Marion Sims. And so, you know, I totally agree with Harriet Washington's stance, but I also tell people to think about contextualizing the social world of the antebellum South. How else would Sims or any of his peers have known to treat Black women and to treat slaves?
So let's right?
These were people.
Yeah, let me play you a comment from Dr. Janice Coleman. And she's, again, mm-hmm. speaking about Marion Sims. She's an OBGYN in Columbia, South Carolina. Here's her first yes. comment.
You have to put it in the context of when he was practicing. This is the mid-1800s, the 19th century. Slavery was in existence. All of his early work, pioneering work, was done on slaves.
And then you have this comment from Judith Burgess, who's the chair of obstetrics and gynecology at the Med School for the University of South Carolina. That is mm-hmm. where Marion Sims was from. And she, it sounds like she's trying to say he wasn't a complete villain.
Dr. James Marion Sims was innovative, he was caring, and he tried to make the lives better for all the patients that he encountered.
How do you respond to that?
So, yeah. So it's also interesting the way the music was playing in the background, right?
It is a little,
James
yeah.
Marion Sims was a 19th century slave-owning physician. And in his autobiography, he describes Black people using the racial epithets of the day, you know, calling them the N-words. He cared no more about those enslaved women's lives than any other slave owner. What he did was he entered into a legal contract with their owners. And so his relationship was not to Anarcha Betsy Lucy and the other unidentified women who he experimented on, but it was with their owners who leased these women's sick bodies to Dr. Sims for him to, in his words, repair or fix. And so to paint a man who owned human beings as property, as some benevolent martyr, I think, you know, is the worst kind of revisionist history. And I use this as someone who is, you know, stands by the label as a revisionist history, because a lot of the history about enslaved people were that they were happy darkies, content with their status and their state. And that's simply not the case. James Marion Sims was a doctor who cared about repairing these women so that they would be, in his words, fit for the duties of their bondage.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Deirdre Cooper Owens. Her book comes out today. It's called Medical Bondage, Race, Gender, and the Origins of American Gynecology. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. So congratulations. It's your book day.
Thank you.
I have been sort of staying away from some of the descriptions of what happened to these women because it's very tough. And he often was experimenting on them without any kind of anesthesia or pain control. This is probably a dumb question, but why?
Because he started to experiment on them in the 1840s, 1844, and he lived in a rural community, Mount Meigs, Alabama, which was about 15 miles outside of Montgomery. James Marion Sims came from the old school, so to speak. And so this was a man who prided himself on his dexterity in terms of surgical repair. And also it was expedient for him to have patients awake. So a part of the positioning of James Marion Sims is that he was either a martyr or either a villain. And so what I'm trying to offer with the research I've done and the book that I've written is that human beings are much more complex than that. And James Marion Sims was much more complex than the kind of binary positioning that we in the 21st century are trying to place him into. And so this was a man who routinely did not use pain numbing medications or anesthetics for his patients. because he wanted to get in, repair it, and be done quickly. A large part of his pride in not giving these women anesthesia during surgery was that he did not want the patients to bleed out. And that was a real possibility with any surgery that was taking place in the 19th century. Also, when he goes to New York about 7 years or so later, 5 or 7 years later, he also doesn't utilize anesthesia on the poorer white patients as well. So there is also a belief that many doctors had that the racial science of the late 18th century and 19th century supported was that certain kinds of bodies, namely black bodies, did not experience pain. And there was also a belief that black women, really women of African descent all over the globe, did not experience pain. And when they did, it was a slight pain. Right?
Yeah. And this came up, since you're a medical historian, this came up again with black soldiers that were treated during the Civil War as well, that
exactly.
There was a continuing view that African-Americans didn't need anesthesia.
Right. And what's interesting for me when I speak to audiences who are, you know, outside of academia, and I like to put the past in conversation with the present, is to point them to studies that have come out, not in 1804 or 1914 or even 1974, but in studies that have come out in the 21st century. In 2014, University of Virginia medical students still believed there were distinct biologically based differences in how black and white people experienced pain, or in the case of black people, did not experience pain. And so a large part of my mission with this book is obviously to reveal the deep linkages that the American institution of slavery had on so many different professions, but also to let them know that there are the lingering effects of this kind of medical racism that we've not quite erased from our medical training in terms of curriculum, but also in the ways that some of these students who are graduating from some of the top schools, you know, are believing these biologically distinct fictions about black and white people in particular.
And you make the argument, we only have about a minute left, but you do make the argument that some of that bias lingers, right?
Yes, it does. It does. And so, you know, if I can change someone like the last OBGYN to perhaps reconsider this hagiographic or, you know, uncritical view of these doctors because of the important work they did. And James Marion Sims did ultimately repair these women's bodies,
yeah,
and they were fertile again and able to bear children. And so we can't forget that. But to not necessarily pay him homage as the father of American gynecology when James Marion Sims states that in the last two and a half years of his experimental surgeries, he had to train his enslaved patients to also work as nurses. And
yeah.
So I need to have the American public also speak about these women in a very literal sense as the mothers,
right,
of gynecology, because they were as much his surgical assistants as,
yeah,
any of the other apprentices that he trained
Alabama. That's Deirdre Cooper Owen. She's assistant professor of history at Queens College. Her latest book, Medical Bondage, hits shelves today, published by the University of Georgia Press. Thank you.
Thank you very much.